Welcome to The Bibliopod, a Maclean's podcast about the highs and the lows of all things literary. Books, reading, writers, feuds, gossip, and what we love and what we loathe. I'm Anne Kingston, a writer with Maclean's magazine.
I'm Brian Bethune, a writer at Maclean's. Today we will talk about Charlie Hebdo, the pen writers controversy, and freedom of expression. We'll weigh in on the quality of the characters who populate federal budgets and other political discourse. That's the literary quality, we assure you, of these fictional characters, not their political, as well as the ethics of book buying in Canada. Guest Tracy Higgins, co-owner of the independent Hamilton, Ontario bookstore, Brian Prince Booksellers, will join us as we discuss showrooming, the dodgy practice of extracting all a staff's information from an independent bookstore before going, if you bother to go, and ordering it online. We will also feature an interview with the Welsh-American, call him Brooklyn writer, John Ronson, author of So You've Been Publicly Shamed. But first, the Charlie Hebdo pen controversy.
So, Brian, what did you think when it was announced that six of 60 writer hosts at the Penn Benefit happening next week in New York had walked because they did not accept the fact that the honoree would be this Charlie Hebdo magazine?
I had been expecting this crack in the sort of progressive point of view for some time. I never liked Charlie Hebdo. I never liked what it was doing. Of course, they don't deserve this. The crime is despicable. And suddenly now they're in a place where you can't criticize them. They're dead, for God's sakes. And now there's enough distance that people are trying to separate what happened to them from the way they used to behave.
I think what's interesting, though, I mean, what about the Penn turmoil itself, is that it reflects, it's juicy in the sense that you have writers who have formed themselves around the notion that of freedom of expression, the sacrosanct notion of freedom of expression, that you seem to see censorship within that ranks. You see, Salman Rushdie has been on Twitter tweeting about his, co-members as pussies, a word that he retracted. So it's a fascinating glimpse into the politics within Penn itself, don't you think?
Yes, it is. And you saw the responses to from Rushdie's followers. It was all these guys were cowards. They're trying to save their lives somehow. But I think this break is taking some sort of bravery on theirs because Penn is really closing ranks. And you can certainly see Rushdie's position. He must have felt abandoned many, many times over what happened to him 27 years ago now.
Well, it's interesting. One of the things that's come out of this, Glenn Greenwald released a series of emails between Penn's executive director, Suzanne Nossel, and the writer, Deborah Eisenberg. And it is a wonderful read because it's back and forth about the very politics of censorship and also what Penn represents within the larger world. And Deborah Eisenberg referred to the Charlie Hebdo cartoons as tasteless, brainless, and also brainlessly reckless. That was her take. And I think a lot of people agree with that. And it's possible to formulate two thoughts at the same time, right? And then what was interesting, though, was Nossel's response, which had to do with the fact that what they were actually doing was Penn was making a larger point by honoring Charlie Hebdo. It wasn't simply Charlie Hebdo. It was a larger principle. And I will read from her note. She said, "We believe that honoring Charlie Hebdo affords us an opportunity to inflect global opinion on an issue of longstanding concern to Penn and to free expression advocates worldwide, including many in the Muslim world, namely efforts to devalue, ban, or punish acts deemed to constitute the defamation of religion. Such assaults come both from governments and from vigilantes, and they are not acceptable in other contexts." It's almost as if they've become a token of a larger point Penn wants to make.
And there's always going to be one in Penn, because Penn's own reaction to the six writers withdrawing was fairly level-headed. And they pointed out, well, we honored Pussy Riot in the past. And Pussy Riot, by stripping clothes off in an Orthodox church, offends people. So there's that religious angle again that matters to Penn so much. But Pussy Riot was probably basically an anti-Putin stance.
Well, you can read it that way, but you can also unbundle
this. Go right back
this
to the religious.
Exactly. It comes down to the religion and what's ripe for mockery and what is not, and where those fault lines lie. And I think it's a very sensitive fault line, and it's a conversation that's difficult to have. And what's interesting to me in the wake of all of this is that polarization we're seeing within Penn itself represents sort of a failure to actually address some of the deeper issues at root here.
Not to mention, as you said, keeping up freedom of expression in their own ranks.
Exactly. Well, the other thing that was interesting, this is my final entry from this fascinating email exchange, and that is, again, Deborah Eisenberg responding. And her point was that she's accusing Penn of asserting that people who are murdered for expressing themselves are automatically deserving of praise, which is a wonderful point of debate, don't you
but,
think?
Yes, but a lot of people probably think so. But you'll notice, especially in progressive thinking, Ayaan Hirsi Ali thinks of herself in the Charlie Hebdo mold. And if you count death threats, she has every reason to think of herself. And yet Penn would probably not be. Certainly progressive thinking is no fan of hers. It's just because she was killed, I think she will join their ranks.
Well, but let's hope that
let's
does
hope
not
she's
happen.
Not. But outside of it, she is a hate monger. And so was Charlie Hebdo to a lot of the left, until they were martyrs.
Well, shall we shift gears to the Canadian political scene, specifically the characters who emerged in last week's federal budget? These are the fictional case studies that we see used in every budget to illustrate the benefits of new policies that are being brought into place. I did a deconstruction that's on the Maclean's website, looking at the budget as a novel and looking at who these characters are and why they were chosen. And one of the things that I couldn't help noticing as I scrolled through all of these examples was the fact that men were the breadwinners, women were the caretakers, men out-earned women, which reflects reality, but also sort of doesn't reflect changing trends. And there was a surprising lack of diversity.
Yeah, that was the most striking thing, that everyone in the budget had ancestors that hailed from the British Isles. It was kind of peculiar, especially the little princess children, Grace and Elizabeth.
Well, we need to set this up. One of the primary cases was a married couple by the name of Henry and Kathy. And they have two children. People in finance provided a lot of details about this family in the sense that they offered the children's names, two girls named Grace and Elizabeth, princesses from the 1950s. And Henry out-earned Kathy, which is a reality, as we say, but at the same time, why did they even have to say? It is about appealing, I think, to a certain demographic.
Exactly. We were looking for approved families. And if you look back to last year's, where they had the slightly more modern Blake and Laurie, Laurie out-earned her husband, $72,000 to $48,000. But we have gone back to normative presentations of the 1950s for this time, because it's an election year, perhaps.
Well, and also the idea of caregivers, female, education, higher institutional learning, men. One woman who was enrolled in a school was a dental hygienist. And it strikes me that these are, you know, we think about our characters, the characters who influence us as coming from fiction. But this fiction of bureaucracy that exists within the political realm, where there are these stereotypes, and we saw them writ large in this year's budget, but we also see them in soccer moms. We saw them in Justin Trudeau's creation of Natalie, too. Right. These are embedded in, I think, the way we see.
And how does this stuff play in Quebec? Every couple that the budget presents is Anglo, except for the seniors, Francois and Helene, who need to retrofit their bathroom.
I really think it's a bit more insidious than even that. If we look at the tropes that talk about the white van man in Britain's politics, which has become a big deal even now, the white van man, the idea of the working class. We have the soccer mom in America, this idea that resonates far beyond the political realm. It infiltrates our commercial life, our
ideas sense of what's normal.
Gender relations even. And what's really wonderful about the soccer mom example, it was employed by a politician, a city council politician for the first time in 1995. She was running for city council. She had a PhD, very impressive kind of managerial background, ran political campaigns. She wanted to be accessible. So she presented herself as a soccer mom. And That, to me, is very telling of right. the way these conventions are used. You know, the one in Britain is used to deflect discussions about class, you know, and also to yeah. polarize the population so we don't have to talk about things that really matter.
Right. Try to present your character as the one you like to go out for a drink with.
Exactly. Well, that, it brings that down, as you say, to the personal level. But you also have Justin Trudeau at the convention in 2014. He brought up this new, you know, fictional character, Natalie, who was a soccer mother or a woman who was preparing oranges for her daughter who was going off to play soccer. And it's this idea of the people who care, the hardworking Canadians, right. we, you know, the politicians insist on talking about. But that's just code, isn't it, for working class? Only we don't say working class anymore. We say middle class.
Right. That the working class should be middle class in aspiration, but the middle class should be working class in their needs, essentially the way we think about this. You're working class when the government is going to help you, but you're middle class in your aspirations.
But it's also true, for instance, in this last budget, which they didn't call a budget. In fact, they called an economic action paper, yes. or EAP, that there was no discussion of poverty. The word was not used. You couldn't find it if you did a search. And also, there was this idea of what was a family?
Right.
Two children, usually.
Always.
And again, you know, men, a male, female family, right. not doesn't even reflect the Canadian reality. There was a couple I didn't mention, Taylor and Damien, who could be a gay couple,
right.
but I kind of thought of Taylor as a female name. They both earned $50,000, but that put them on the threshold of $100,000 incomes, which isn't reality either, because right. the dual income household is less than that in this country.
Well, you have to go back 2009 before there's a single parent. It's been couples ever since.
Because that is
who all tax relief is targeted at. It's always couples.
But don't you think that there's a larger sort of schema at play? I'm not suggesting that they're sitting around like, you know, Gustave Flaubert in finance trying to put together some, you know, complex
organism. No, but this is an idea of
who is
approved. It's not just who might vote for us, but I think it is a picture of who is an approved family, who is approved Canadian.
Exactly. There's that sense of who belongs and who
right.
doesn't.
Yeah.
And I just can't help but thinking that this... The document that the literature of this last election platform speaks volumes.
Well, I think they should listen to us and write something far more complicated.
Okay, we'll be waiting next year.
Next year. In our next segment, we're going to discuss the fraught business of bookselling in Canada, the deplorable practice known as showrooming, and the rather new practice known as webrooming. Can we get these straight, Anne?
Well, I think, yes, showrooming is essentially the practice of going to a bookstore and taking out your phone and taking down the data on the phone, either taking a picture or a barcode. Amazon had an app a few years ago it was bragging about and telling people to use that and getting it. They get a discount if they went home and bought on Amazon. And then you have webrooming, which is the converse practice involving going online, maybe looking at Goodreads on the Amazon site or some other aggregator, deciding what you want to buy, and then going to your local bookseller to do it. Now, obviously, showrooming is the concern. And the question becomes, you know, what is it about books that makes us fret so, the way we don't fret, for instance, about buying a plasma TV at Best Buy.
Exactly. If you go into an electronics store and check out all their details, including their prices, and then go, well, it's cheaper online or it's cheaper down the block, you're merely a canny shopper. But when you do that with a book, you are crossing some various ethical lines. Now, you were talking about showrooming light, which is just going in and scanning what's there. But the dark side of showrooming is taking up the staff's time and effort and knowledge that you cannot get yet online, and then still going online. That's the part that sends the booksellers around the bend. Everybody wants what's in a bookstore, whether they want to pay for it or not, because we cannot browse electronically yet.
And the thing about a book is that within, I think, the popular imagination, it's both fungible in the sense that any issue of Gone Girl is right. the same as any other.
Exactly.
Yet the experience of reading that book is unique. So that's a complicated equation.
Yes, they cross a line in which they're selling, as you say, every copy of Gone Girl is the same, but it's coming equipped with specialized knowledge of the sellers. It's not like, doesn't matter who you buy your bulk diapers from, but it may well matter who you buy the book from, even though they could ship it to you by a drone just as easily.
No, and there's such serendipity that's involved, even at looking, if you do go to big chain and you look at the table at the staff picks, which is, again, this kind of attempt to personalize the experience, right? You don't know who the hell Harry or Susan are, but you're trusting their literary taste.
They work in a bookstore,
but
for one thing.
The surprise aspect of being in a bookstore and the engagement just of being around all of those books.
You can't do that online. I know Amazon bought Goodreads to try to make this virtual browsing thing.
What do you think of Goodreads?
I'd much rather be in a bookstore, thank you.
Okay, we should devote the entire episode to Goodreads. Well, it's an interesting sign of the times, isn't it, that last month, Architectural Digest did a rundown on the most beautiful bookstores in the world. And it's a reminder of, these were shrines and well worth checking out, but it's a reminder of just that unique place, the bookstore, more than any other, I think, type of store. Correct me if I'm wrong here, but maybe I'm talking to the wrong person.
No, I'm obviously going to agree on that. I can't think of another sort of store that is as enticing as a bookstore. That is a thing of such beauty. We are joined on the Bibliopod by Tracy Higgins, who is co-owner of Brian Prince Bookseller in Hamilton, Ontario, and someone who's been through the wars in the indie bookstore business. How long have you been in the trade, Tracy?
I started at the bookstore here in 1990, so I'm in my 25th year in the book trade.
How has the internet affected your business?
The internet is probably the biggest peril facing bookstores. There's enough room in the marketplace for the chain stores and for the independents, and that was not the big issue. The big issue is online shopping. That's what kills us in terms of the deep discounting, in terms of, you know, unreasonable expectations.
We're really interested in consumer habits from your perspective. How has shopping in your store changed, or more specifically, what drives you crazy?
Well, I'll preface all of my comments with an acknowledgement that for the most part, our customers are wonderful.
Of course, of course.
They're amazingly supportive. And, you know, while we do experience the showrooming and some of the more overt competition with online shopping, we have customers who actually operate in the opposite direction, where they will search things online and then come to us to order them. But the showrooming drives me nuts. I understand and I openly acknowledge that, you know, in tight times, people are looking to make their dollar go as far as it can. And I get that. At the same time, what drives me nuts, more than someone coming in and, you know, browsing around our store and then buying something online because, you know, they want to get it cheaper, that's frustrating. But what's exasperating is when they come in and they will use your time and use your information and the years of accumulated knowledge being a bookseller, and then take all of that information and go get it cheaply.
So that's what crosses the line.
That does.
The rest of it is shopping to a degree, right? Which we do with everything else.
Exactly. And if it's just, you know, just the price advantage, that's one thing. But as a for instance, we had a customer who asked for recommendations just with a topic, and we spent hours searching out books that fit the parameters and sent them a document that had the title, all of the information with the price, and then sent it to them and said, let us know whether or not you want to order any of these. And we got back our document, not even rewritten, but our document with Amazon prices substituted in and asked us to price match it. And it was just, it was one of those things, I couldn't even figure out how you've come to the conclusion that that's okay.
What was your response?
Our response was to say, we don't price match. What you are paying for is the hours that we put into compiling this list and, you know, all the knowledge, the accumulated and collective knowledge of the booksellers in the store, that is what you're paying for.
That is such an extreme, it sounds like such an extreme case. Are there other ways you can tell someone is showrooming? Are there tells for showrooming customers?
Well, it's hard because you don't want to demonize everyone with a cell phone, right? And if they have a cell phone in their hand and they're not a showrooming customer, they will become almost self-conscious. I'm just looking up a list. It's like, it's okay. Right. It's all right. You're allowed. You know, we have Wi-Fi access. You are allowed. So it's a very, very delicate balance that you're trying not to make people feel conspicuous or self-conscious because they are looking up a list of things or because they're checking an email. But we've had people taking pictures and scanning, and you can hear the little click of the phone, and they're scanning barcodes, and that's pretty much your easiest tell. The one nice thing is that the old part of our store has the original tin ceiling, which interrupts Wi-Fi access.
Did you?
It's actually very handy sometimes.
There was this infamous example a few years ago when Amazon put out its check price app. Did you have any experience with that? Did that happen in your store?
We had one customer, and again, it's just one of the, you're just standing there with your mouth hanging open thinking, what are you thinking of? And it was a Christmas shopping customer who was showing us this amazing app at the front counter of the store. And Nancy and I, who had been here since, you know, pretty much the store opened, and just, that's awesome.
We're laughing, but it's not funny.
No, it's not. And I'm not sure where the disconnect is. And that's why I find it so hard to fight against it. I'll give you another example. We had a customer who came in and had one of the booksellers for a good 15, 20 minutes checking all the information on his textbooks for school and made sure with the publisher those were the latest editions. This is all the information that you need. Bookseller asked him, would you like us to order them? And without a word of a lie, he said, why would I do that when I can get them cheaper on Amazon? And of course, the bookseller was surprised and I think shocked enough that didn't know how to react and told me about it afterward. And I said, point this person out to me if they come back. And it is only by the grace of God that when this person came back 2 weeks later, I wasn't in the store because his second visit was to give us a resume and ask if we were hiring.
Oh.
And that's the kind of disconnect. I don't understand the service and the time and all of that. There's no perceived value for that. Whereas if I went to a vet for a consultation or if I went to a mechanic for a consultation, the expectation is that I'm paying for their knowledge, whether or not they do the work for me.
Now, you did mention the reverse happening in your store, the web rooming, that people are coming back to you. And I'm curious about that experience. What are they coming back to you with? What has the internet given them that benefits you in the end?
We've had people send us their Amazon list and say, these are the things that I want. And they've compiled that, I can tell, over time. So we have people who do the web rooming and who do all of their own sort of searching around to make sure that the title that they're ordering is the one that they need or that the one that they want. And then they'll come to us and order it.
That's the information that you can give in the service you provide that does bind your customers to you.
Mm-hmm. In some ways, it's the community, too, because even if they're not from our physical community, the books, you know, book readers and book lovers are, you know, a relatively tight community. You know, we've seen children who have grown up and now have children of their own. So there's a whole feeling of community and being in a place where you're known and it's comfortable for a lot of people.
Thank you very much, Tracy. We're out of time for this segment now, but thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for asking me.
Okay.
Right. Bye-bye.
Moving on to our next segment, John Ronson, the Brooklyn writer who wrote the continuing bestseller, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. You came into this via a sort of an spam-botting, if that's a verb, an experience of seeing yourself being caricatured online, right?
Right, yeah, to be spam-botted. I didn't realise that it had a verb now. Yes, I discovered that there was another John Ronson on Twitter with my face and my name, but a completely different personality. I wouldn't say that it was a caricature because it was nothing like
that. Right, yeah, it was a different version of you, obsessed with food.
Personality and all these people following it. you know, who were kind of people who enjoyed my books and people that I knew from real life, you know, were all perplexed, you know, that I'd suddenly, you know, changed, you know, profoundly altered my personality.
Right. So that gave you a bit of a feeling and made you think of online shamings that you had been a part of and what had happened to those on the other end.
Exactly, because, you know, I put up the video up of these guys on YouTube. And even though I'd been worried about being shamed myself because I'd been so screechy in the confrontation with these men, it wasn't me who was shamed, it was them.
Right.
And I was thrilled, you know, as I say in the book, that, you know, the world, people around the world were uniting to tell me that I was right. You know, there was this fantastic kind of frenzy of approval going on.
It's yes or no, the online world's coming down on you or it's bucking you up.
Exactly. I was either a hero or a villain. I was either a magnificent hero or a sickening villain. As it turned out, I was the magnificent hero and they were the sickening villain. So of course, I was delighted, but also understood, you know, in that moment that we were like toddlers crawling towards a gun, you know, with this weapon that we didn't understand.
Even if you're portraying Justine Sacco as she wants to see herself, it doesn't anger the people who demonized her before.
Well, it's funny. My book was extracted in the New York Times a few weeks
right.
ago.
Right, yes.
And a bunch of things happened. Primarily, people were saying, you know, that they loved the story. And I was, you know, they kind of congratulated me for being kind of kind and compassionate. And then I noticed actually somebody tweeted something along the lines of, all you bastards retweeting John Ronson's article about Justine Sacco as if you weren't the fuckers who were doing it to begin with. And I think there's, I must say, I thought that was probably true.
Right.
I thought some of the people who were commending me for, you know, finally saying the right thing about Justine Sacco were probably the same bastards who tore her apart. But then there was a little bit of a backlash where, you know, a couple of days afterwards, people were like, a much smaller minority, you know, most people were really positive about the story. But then there was a smaller minority of people saying, you know, what racist is John Ronson going to put his cape on for next? So I got a little bit of a...
Oh, you did.
It's called a flaming, you know, people flamed me.
Right.
And I didn't reply to any of them.
Okay.
And at one point, somebody wrote, you know, why is John Ronson not replying to any of us? And I saw somebody else replied, because John Ronson only replies to men. Which I wanted to say to them, I have no male friends. All my friends are women. But I stayed completely quiet. But that just made me realise exactly what Hank said to me, by the way. Hank said to me, you know what, you're just fitting into people's preconceived ideologies.
Yes. Now, here's a line from you, I believe, that I really like, that the public online shaming gets delivered like a remote-controlled drone strike, and we don't look and see what kind of wreckage was left behind.
Yes.
And
that is what I wanted to do in this book. I wanted to show people the wreckage. I wanted to show people, you know, what they did to the people that they destroyed.
Right, and it is so personalized. It's never about, here's a stupid idea or an evil idea or a bad expression. It's, there's a stupid or evil person out there that needs to be crushed. It's very personal.
Yeah, absolutely. And yet, you know, if you ask us, you know, how we imagine the person is who was just torn apart, our reply would normally be, oh, I'm sure they're fine.
Oh, yeah, exactly. She's a billionaire's daughter anyway.
exactly.
We make up stories about them.
Yeah, she's a billionaire's daughter. She's a racist. She's a. In fact, after my New York Times piece, my New York Times book extract came out, I noticed that came up again. It's like, you know, I can't believe John Ronson defended this privileged, you know, racist.
Yeah.
She's a billionaire's daughter.
Right.
She's a billionaire's daughter. But I just, you know, I didn't reply because I thought this, you know, there's nothing to be gained from getting involved in this. And eventually somebody said, oh, no, I think she's not a billionaire's daughter. I think that's been, debunked.
And that's one of the key things about it, because it's always in the mind of those doing the shaming an attack on privilege. And a defense of the powerless. So it tends to move from left to right, but not always. So you got Sacco, who's everybody's favorite cautionary tale, who's apparently mocking sick black people. And you got Hank, who's crushing a little girl's dreams and threatening a grown woman who's there. And you flip it over to Adria, who's using, in 4chan's mind, feminist privilege to crush the working class. And then you get Mosley offending no one at all. So
yes, exactly. And, you know, Joe Dallaire, I think, probably fits into that, too, because, you know, he kind of was misusing privilege to an extent because, you know, he did live in a mansion in the Hollywood Hills. And, you know, even so, that, you know, there was a sort of tearing apart of Jonah that was, you know, brutal and gleeful. But it was still a matter of privilege, you know, perceived misuse of privilege. I just think, you know, the difference was in Jonah's case, there actually was a source of misuse of privilege going on. I think you could probably say the same about Lindsay Stone as well. Even though it was the rights that attached Lindsay, it was again, you know, a perceived misuse of privilege because she had the privilege of living in a free country that the war dead.
Right.
Fought for. So that
and it's coming from people who think they're disrespected.
Yes, absolutely. And you're absolutely right. It's privilege. You know, the worst sin these days is privilege. Now, of course, a misuse of privilege. Now, of course, that is a worse thing. But it just goes to show that, you know, it's very easy to make a mistake. And it's a terrifying thought that we have made a mistake.
And the way Moynihan found himself turning into a witch finder general, people spontaneously confessing to him.
Yeah, I think it's extraordinary that happens. These two poor people tragically confessing to him. And you know, it's not just journalism. I think I did a TV show in England the other day, like a live 3-hour. You know, breakfast show.
Right.
And the presenter said to me in the dressing room, he said, I spend, you know, I do this every week for 3 hours. I spend the entire 3 hours in a paroxysm of complete panic that I'm going to get off the air after 3 hours and realize that something I'd said 2 hours earlier, I've just got to be destroyed.
Yes. Well, the other thing that all the shamies, the real shamies, have is the fact that they're not that privileged. They all get fired.
Yes.
Except, again, for Mosley, who doesn't have a boss. And that's Mosley's main difference, everybody else, class. But
class, and also it's just lucky that his scandal is a scandal that people just didn't really care about.
Yeah. He's got a lot going for him in that sense. But all these privileged people are fired, and it comes down to their employees who you know are not firing them for moral outrage reasons.
But they're employing them, I guess, out of fear, right? Out of fear that they'll be the next to be attacked by social media. I have two huge terrors in the world. You know, one is that something will happen to my family and when I can't get them on the phone, my mind just spirals. And the other is exactly what we talked about before, you know, the idea that I've done something wrong in my work and it's going to, you know, explode.
Right, and you get fired and you get just doomed.
Yeah, shamed and you know, defined by a mistake as opposed to one's mistake being put into a kind of wider human context. One thing that's really come out there since I wrote this book is the number of journalists who've said to me, you know, I live in terror. You know, this seems to be a kind of widespread terror amongst journalists.
That was John Ronson speaking from Sheffield, the author of the continually best-selling and still talked about So You've Been Publicly Shamed.
That concludes this episode of the Bibliopod. If you'd like to rant or rave about anything you heard today on the podcast, please contact us at letters@macleans.rogers.com. The Bibliopod is produced by Sarmishta Subramanian. The music by Stephen Scratt and Asher Lenz. Additional music by Simon Gadke. We'd like to thank Alan Elliott and Scott Medcalf and Anne Lavery for technical assistance. Please join us next time on the Bibliopod.